Hello and welcome along to another episode of Glow West, where we chat about sex, sexuality and the body, all from a sexual wellness perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm delighted to be part of the Tortoise Shack Network. You can find a whole range of podcasts there. And if you like what we do, please consider supporting us via patreon.com/tortoiseshack. My guest today is talking about something that is probably a lot more common than we think and something that a lot of people suffer in silence with. So Lisa McKenzie, she's the co-founder of the Vaginismus Network, a community for people with vaginismus, which aims to raise awareness of the condition and connect, support and empower those living with it. After living with it herself for many years and feeling broken and isolated, Lisa decided to take control of the situation. She met Kat Wilson, a vaginismus blogger, and very quickly they set up the Vaginismus Network after realising how life-changing it is to meet someone else who truly understands what you are going through. Lisa is passionate about supporting and empowering others living with vaginismus and providing them with the sense of community that she believes that she could have benefited from as a young girl growing up with the condition. Lisa, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you keeping?
Thank you for having me. No. Yeah, I'm keeping very well, actually. It's a day off for me today, so I'm very relaxed and chilled.
Oh, happy days. Yes, we like days off. Brilliant. I suppose like your bio is just, there's so much I want to pick apart in your bio. There's so okay. much. I suppose first things first, we might explain what the condition actually is, just for those who maybe aren't aware or have something going on that might actually realize that it applies to them.
Yeah, of course. So vaginismus, I must say, I love the way you say it with your accent, vaginismus. Oh. It's much nicer and it's actually got the word nice in it. So.
Oh, there we go.
I don't usually like the word. But vaginismus is essentially a condition whereby a person's vagina or vaginal muscles will involuntarily clamp up upon any attempt at penetration. So that could be a penis, which seems the obvious choice, but it's more than that. So it could be a speculum if somebody wants to get a cervical smear test. It could be a tampon, a moon cup, somebody's, you know, little finger, absolutely anything. I believe there's from my experience and from talking to other people that there's definitely a spectrum of how it can affect an individual. So for some people, penetration can be difficult and uncomfortable. For others, it can be painful or extremely painful. And for some, it's just impossible. There's two forms of vaginismus. So primary vaginismus is where the person has struggled with penetration ever since kind of they first attempted to. So I struggled with penetration from the age of 16, 17. So I fall into that category. And then secondary vaginismus can occur at any stage in somebody's life. So they could have experienced a healthy, comfortable sex life or had no issues with penetration. And then something may happen. So it could be trauma. It could be a very difficult childbirth experience. It could be that they're undergoing treatment for gynecological cancer, etc. But something will happen to then bring on the vaginismus. So that's secondary as well.
Okay, so that's interesting that people know that there's two different levels to it, I suppose. It's not just something you're born with, it can happen to you later in life as well. So yeah. That's an important point of like the education around it, because I can imagine that there's so many people who've never even heard of it, maybe until it happens to them. Or I know you're based in the UK. Is this part of sex education over there? I'm going to guess that's a no.
No, I would, I mean, perhaps, I mean, I you know, I'm not an expert. I don't know what is covered at, you know, in every single school out there. Perhaps it is mentioned, but from my experience and understanding and conversations with other people, it isn't. And there's definitely a lot of improvement to be made in the sex education space more broadly, you know, talking about conditions like vaginismus, but also talking about things like porn literacy, consent, you know, sexuality. It feels like sex education is still quite basic and black and white. So I didn't hear about it. And I always think that, you know, had I heard about it as part of my sex education, which was very, very limited, It could have made a massive difference to me, because maybe when I started to struggle with penetration and these issues, if I'd had a word for this condition, maybe I would have had the confidence to speak to my mom or speak to a friend and say, "Oh, I think this is actually what I'm struggling with." But I hadn't heard about it, and I didn't, even when I started kind of struggling with the issue, I still didn't have a word for it for a long, long time.
And that always just makes me sad, because that's how people suffer in silence, because they aren't aware that this is a thing. And it can be quite, I suppose, uncomfortable for a lot of people to talk to partners about it, or even talk to their doctor about it as well, because we don't have those sexual literacy skills, I suppose, to know if something is wrong or some whatever, because we just crowd that like one third of our body part in shame and silence.
It's a real shame. And I'm so passionate now about communicating about it. And I'll talk about anything now. Nothing's too much information with me, but maybe a part of that is because I spent a very long time not talking about it. So I was in my first relationship lasted 8 years. We did not talk about the elephant in the room, which is unbelievable to think now. And I meet young girls now, and people who are struggling with vaginismus, and they are more vocal about it. And there's a lot more support out there for this, generation now. But for myself, yeah, I guess we felt so ashamed that we couldn't have sex in the way that our friends were supposedly having sex, and the conversation around it, even if there was a conversation, shut down very quickly. So it was a very unusual, unhealthy kind of first relationship to have, because we still had a sex life. But I guess it impacted me because I never felt quite good enough, because I wasn't giving him this one thing that's kind of deemed the way to have sex, penis and vagina sex. I wasn't giving him that. I couldn't give him that. So I definitely overcompensated in many other ways, because I wanted to feel like I'm still a woman and I'm still worthy. So yes, I enjoyed our sex life sometimes, but a lot of the time I wasn't really present or in the room. I was sort of going through the motions for that person, because I felt like I had to make it up to them for being broken. But as you were talking about, communication, we didn't talk about it. After that relationship, I didn't talk about it because I didn't have a word for it. So I didn't really know how to articulate the problem. And I guess I felt like by that stage it spiraled so much that I felt like I was too far, in it to get myself out of it. I felt completely stuck.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? And it's just like I talk for a bit on the show about authentic sex and authentic forms of pleasure, and we have to break through a lot of media conversations around that, of like how women are like supposed to be when it comes to sex, and how a lot of us engage in performative sex. We're more into we're told to be more sexy as opposed to sexual, and taking ownership of our own bodies. But yeah, when something goes wrong like that, it's like you said, you're overcompensating on the other side of things. So yeah, it would break your heart really, because that shame is something that I'm quite passionate about trying to bust things down. And if you're internalizing that, like you said, you used the word broken there. That's pretty heartbreaking to have to feel like that as a young person you're trying to figure out your sex life anyway, as a young person. So when you have a medical issue thrown into it, like feeling broken is just, yeah, heartbreaking.
It's weird talking about it now, because I feel very different, because I feel much more empowered, setting up the network, but also just being more vocal with friends and family about it. It's definitely given me that strength. So it feels so weird to be talking about how I used to live, but I certainly was not very. Obviously, I was happy. I had a good life, but I felt like an actress a lot of the time, because we pretended our relationship was perfect and grand, and we didn't talk about the issue. And then when you do feel broken, and you sort of, it's all completely internalized, because you're not talking to anybody about it, it can impact other things like your mental health, your self-esteem, how you, you know, your worth. This sounds very woe me, by the way. I don't want it
no,
to come
no,
across
no, no.
like this.
But it's your real experiences, though,
it's like
as
a therapy
well.
Session.
Yeah. I'll charge you €60
I'll
by the end
the
of it.
Tissues.
Yeah. No, but I think that's a really important part, because our sexual health is just as valuable as our physical health and our mental health. And
absolutely,
and this
yeah.
is why, you know, I talk about sex through that sexual wellness perspective of, you know, we have holistic wellness, and how we treat our sex life is impacts so much of the rest of our wellness. So I was struck when I was reading your bio about how empowered you were in setting up the network, and you met your friend Kat, and you both
yeah.
Set it up then. Talk to me about that process, because I'm always fascinated with people who want to help others and actually go and do that and stand up for other people, which is amazing.
Yeah, it happened really organically, actually. So I was seeing my therapist, and I'd opened up to a couple of friends about vaginismus. So I was starting to feel a bit more confident and in control. And then I was determined to connect with someone else with vaginismus. But until that point, everything I'd found online was, I couldn't personally relate to it. So for whatever reason, maybe the information I didn't personally find empowering, or I found it quite clinical or not very personable. And then I stumbled across Kat, and she was a blogger, and she talked about her vaginismus experience. And wow, I found her blog, and I literally like consumed the whole back catalogue of them in like a day. I read about her
That's
whole life
and
experience. But also what made me want to read it and what made me feel connected to her was she was so human about her experience, but also really funny and, you know, just honest. And she took the mickey out of herself, which sometimes you just need to do to help cope. So yeah, I read a whole back catalogue of her blogs, and then I didn't reach out to her for about 3 months, because I just felt really nervous. And maybe I thought, oh, if I reach out to somebody, like, this makes it more real now. But anyway, I reached out to her by email. I think it was December 2016, yes. And she literally replied within the hour. And I remember reading her response and just crying and crying. I was at home on my Aww. Own. But for somebody to say, like, I feel like I'm reading about myself, I absolutely get everything you've told me and shared with me, I could not believe it. Like, I felt so light, and I felt like this massive weight had been lifted. And then we clicked quite quickly. I always say with Kat, it was really fortunate, actually, because she could have been anybody at the other end of the screen. Like, she could have been, you know, someone 2 decades older than me, 1 decade younger, with very different interests. We had quite similar interests as well, and a similar sense of humor. So we really quickly clicked, and we were WhatsApping lots, and just kind of venting about dilating and, you know, this is fucking shit. And it was so, sorry, I don't know if you swear
no,
on this
you go for it. You're not the
sorry.
First, don't worry.
As soon as I said that, I was like, oh, crap.
You're right, it's yeah. Ireland, like, we're used to it.
So it just, yeah, became this nice rhythm of kind of sharing our experiences through WhatsApp and venting. And then we met up a few months later. She always says she got the short straw. I think I did kind of have her a little bit, because she's up in Glasgow in London. We met in Birmingham. So she traveled for a long time. I got like an hour and a half train. but yeah, it was like almost like a blind date, because we hadn't met in person. And we basically spent the night in Birmingham, had dinner and drinks, and just chatted and chatted and chatted. And it was incredible, because I was finally in the presence of somebody, you know, this human being here. And I was talking about my experience, and they were just nodding away and rolling their eyes at the things and getting frustrated at the same things. And I think she'd met someone else with vaginismus before that, but for me, I was blown away. And we both said, you know, how can we create this experience for other people who are feeling really isolated and kind of suffering on their own with vaginismus, or just want that sense of community, sorry, because even if you've spoken to, you know, friends and families or your GP or a therapist, there's nothing quite like connecting with somebody who has lived the experience and just gets it. So we said, let's do something, like, let's set something up. And I guess for me, it felt right, because I'm quite a very empathetic person. So I'm quite an empath, and I'm quite sensitive. I naturally want to help others anyway. And I thought, actually, this has controlled my life for so long. Perhaps doing something about it and helping other people is another way of me taking back control. And it's definitely helped in that way so much. But yeah, the process of setting up the network was like, people say, oh gosh, did you guys do loads of research and planning? And did you, you know, it must have been a long process. And it was so organic. Like, we set it up about 4 months after we met. And the sole purpose of it was just to connect other people with vaginismus. So I remember saying to Kat, look, if we can help two people and make them feel less alone and better, then our job is done. It doesn't matter what else happens. So the main thing we do is connect people, but we also want to raise awareness and educate people. And we want to empower people as well. So I'm conscious of the information that we put out there. And I always want it to be, you know, realistic. It's a difficult, it can be a traumatic thing to go through and live with, but I want people to see that actually we're human. You know, we've also got cool lives, and this is just something that we deal with, and it shouldn't define you. So we try and empower people. A big part of what we do that's grown is the blog as well, because I'm always conscious that I don't want to be, you know, become the vaginismus poster girl. I'm one person with my own experience. And there's so many people out there who are living it and have so many different experiences. Like, even between myself and Kat, you know, she is married with vaginismus. She's been married for 10 years. I've been single for many, many years. So those experiences and kind of dealing with dating and marriage and vaginismus are different in themselves. So we ask people to write in, whether it's anonymously or if they want to put their name out there and share their stories as well. And that's been amazing, because there's so many stories to be told. And also, in turn, that empowers people as well.
It is empowering, and that's, I can hear that through your voice and through everything you're saying there. You can see that passion, and it's genuine. You know, you're not, this isn't just like, oh, it's a business venture or whatever. It's actually authentic, and like you said, organic at the start, and that's what the best things come from, authenticity. Like, in doing research for this, I was looking at videos on YouTube, and it's people in, like, doctors in white coats, and it's very clinical, and like, within 3 minutes, not even 3 minutes, like 3 seconds almost, they're like, this is very painful, and you're like, yeah. Okay, like, it is, but, like, you know, maybe just lead in a bit more gently, maybe, or, you know, it's not as accessible. It kind of contributes to, like, fear, whereas your blog and your social media is like color and, you know, fun and accessibility. And I think that's a huge way of enhancing this discussion about this. And that's really important. If you consider that, like, when you started, it was silence, so there was nothing, and you've literally brought light and color to it and life. And I think that's really important to acknowledge that, and to say, like, it is, like, it's working, because you're having people contribute and that creating that sense of a community around it as well.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot that you said that, actually. And yeah, I definitely, you know, want it to be everything that you've just said, because I always think, so when I was in my early mid-20s, I did do a little bit of Googling of the symptoms I was experiencing. And of course, the word vaginismus came up. But the information was exactly as you've described, kind of, you know, quite scary and straight to the point and quite cold and clinical. And I always think, you know, had I found something, I feel like I'm blowing my own trumpet now, I hate to do it, but had I found something like the network, which I try and create what I could have used as a young girl growing up with this condition, and I think I would have found this helpful. And I always think, had I found the network when I was in my early 20s, Googling and feeling really alone and nervous about it, maybe my progress would have been different, and maybe I would have started dealing with it at a much earlier age. But I didn't start dealing with it until I was about 32, or maybe 30. About 30, I think, actually. But, you know, that's, we're talking like 8 years difference, still kind of living it, feeling alone and isolated.
That's huge. Yeah. And yeah. And talk to me, you said that you were single there and Kat is married. So obviously, sex is a massive part of most people's lives. So how exactly does it affect sex? I know that there's differences between penetration is not impossible or not possible, and then some, for some it's possible, but it's very painful as well.
So there are people I've spoken to who have, achieved penetrative sex in relationships and marriage and dating or whatever. I've spoken to many people, and for some of them, it's absolutely fine, and they're comfortable with it now, and in their mind, they've overcome it and it's sorted. For some, it's something that they can do, but actually they found that other ways to have sex are actually more enjoyable for them, and they don't always want to have penetrative sex, and that's quite empowering in itself, because I think when you put penetrative sex up here on this pedestal, and then you can have penetrative sex after a long time of wanting it, and actually you're like, oh, there's yeah, it's fine, but actually other ways of sex are actually more enjoyable. I think that's quite empowering. So yeah, I know of some people who are absolutely fine now and comfortable and enjoy it. I know people who it's part of their toolkit, but they also enjoy having sex in other ways. And that's one of the messages that we put out there with Hazel Mead, the illustrator. I'm not sure if you've
Oh,
heard
I
of her.
love her work. Yeah, it's very
Yeah,
soft, gentle illustrations.
she's really, really talented. And I met her through the network, and we met up one day in the park, and we were just having this conversation, and we both said how empowering it was for us when it clicked, and we were like, actually, sex is more than penis and vagina, and there's a whole wealth of ways you can have sex. But growing up with vaginismus and thinking that's the only way to have sex, and I'm
That's
not
what
a
our
woman if I
culture
can't do
says.
that. I know, but it's
Like
so, it
every
impacts
episode or every issue of like Cosmopolitan
Yes.
or Sex in the City, it's penis and vagina, and that
I
is how people have
know.
sex.
So that's why we collaborated on that piece, because we thought we want to make people see that, that's one way to have sex and it's great, but there's all these other ways as well. And again, it's about empowering people, because maybe if I'd have seen that message as a young girl, I would have felt less broken and, yeah, more, I don't know,
Yeah. And
just
even,
whole.
well, like our language around that even is like every other form of sex that isn't penis and vagina sex is considered foreplay. And it's like
Yes,
it
and
can
it
be sex in
shouldn't be.
itself.
Exactly, yeah. Foreplay, I think, should just be banned as a word. I think
That's your next campaign.
Yes.
Talk to me about the symptoms of it then. So how do you know if you have this or if you suspect that something's going on? Like what, so what's the reality of it?
Kat always uses a good analogy. It's basically like, I guess, the physical manifestation. If I try to poke you in the eye, you would automatically close your eye. It's basically
That
like
gives you a
that.
pretty good idea.
There's a
That's
good
quite an
physical
excellent
manifestation.
example.
Yeah, it's always a useful analogy.
Yeah.
That's basically what it's like. Some people describe it as almost like hitting a brick wall. Like in my yeah, definitely when I was struggling a lot with it in my first relationship, it was like, we're just hitting a brick wall here. This is not working. And it was painful. I know people who have found it, I think, a lot more painful than I have. So kind of like excruciatingly painful. But yeah, it's just penetration is either hitting a brick wall, not going in, not happening, or really, really painful and forced.
So the vagina is like tightening up
Yeah,
completely.
the muscles will
Yeah.
involuntarily clamp up, and it's a condition which is, mind and body connected, so psychosomatic kind of condition, because your brain is essentially protecting you from perceived pain or discomfort or something. And it can be confusing, because so for myself, so people with primary vaginismus, for some of them, there's a clear reason. So they, might have sadly experienced sexual abuse or trauma or something before they started to have a sex life, or like penetrative sex, or they might have had like experienced a strict religious upbringing, or just negative messaging around sex anyway. For me, there was no real obvious reason. And it baffled me. All I can think is, I think as young people growing up, we're like sponges and we just soak in all these messages around us. And I do remember hearing messages around, you know, your first time is going to hurt and be painful and you're going to bleed.
That's the only
so
message
I think
you get
I absorbed
sometimes.
That and it kind of, you know, it registered, it kind of locked there in my subconscious. So I think that's it. And I do remember when I first tried to have penetrative sex and it didn't work as we wanted it to. And I remember feeling, you know, humiliated and embarrassed and disappointed, but not surprised, which is really weird. It's like, yeah, this was always going to happen. It's strange. I think something there was telling me it's going to be difficult for you.
Well, it's built up to be painful. Like that's such a common, I don't even know if it's a myth or a trope, or you will bleed the first time you have sex, which is obviously connected to your hymen and stuff. But like the idea of blood and pain mixed together, like it doesn't sound like it's going to be a very pleasant experience. And of course your brain wants to protect you from that. Yeah.
So I think I just built up a lot of those messages and I had this, like, all of them in my mind, maybe, I don't know, but subconsciously, because like I say, I didn't really, it wasn't that obvious.
So, and when you went looking for help, like, how is the medical profession, like, do they solely put it down to a physical thing? Do they solely keep it as a mental health thing, or were they accepting that it is actually part of both?
So I wasn't actually diagnosed via a GP. I was diagnosed through psychosexual therapy. So I had quite a bad experience on a night out one night a few years ago where I put myself in this vulnerable position to try and prove something. And it was a not very nice experience. And that almost was my trigger to go, a wake-up call, sorry, to go, right, you've got to sort this out now. This is, you know, there's something going on here. And through that experience, I spoke to a friend of mine who has a relative who's a psychosexual therapist, and she trains people as well. And my friend spoke to her relative and said, like, I've got this friend who needs some psychosexual therapy or support. And I was put in touch with my therapist via this. And it was amazing because she was newly qualified. So, because I couldn't afford therapy at that stage. Yeah, so that's one thing, you know, some people can't afford it. Yeah. So I got it at a lower cost because she was building up her practice as well. And I remember her quite early on saying the word vaginismus. And I was like, no, go away. No. I was in total denial because, like I say, everything I'd read about it didn't really make me feel hopeful. And I just didn't want to be associated with it. So I shut her down quite quickly. And I'd say it was, you know, I did see her for a while, and I'd say it was at least a couple of years until we started talking about it. And I guess it was because I had a lot to unpack from my that 8-year relationship, because we didn't communicate, and there was a lot of mental health impacts in terms of, you know, just internalizing it all on my own and feeling that way. So we had kind of sorted through all of that, and then I got to a place where I was like, okay, can we talk about vaginismus? Because I think this is what it is.
Did she say, I told you so years ago?
I think she might have said, I do remember us talking about it, and you basically saying, shush, shut up now.
But do you think that's a common thing that people would be in denial? I can imagine it would be.
Yeah, I think lots of people are in denial. There shouldn't be any shame attached to it, but there is. So I think some people are in denial. I think some people have, and I always need to caveat that there are some amazing GPs and health professionals out there, but I also hear stories of people who go to their GP to talk about the fact that they think they have vaginismus, and sometimes the GP will Google what is vaginismus in front of them. I've heard of people who've been told to, you know, go and drink a glass of wine and relax, it will be fine. I've heard of people who are told you need to have more sex, or conversely, you need to have less sex. And I've said this on every podcast I've spoken on, and I feel like a broken record, but I do really wish that when somebody you know, finds the courage to go to their GP and talk about something that's incredibly personal, that they will at least be met with A, understanding of the condition, and B, passion and empathy. And it feels like it's always a bit of a gamble. And I said recently to somebody, you know, I would never want to discourage anybody from going to their GP because they're professionals. You know, I can't diagnose. I can just talk and support. I'm not a professional. Definitely go to your GP, but just arm yourself, or just mentally prepare yourself with the fact that you might not get the response or reaction from them that you want or deserve. And it shouldn't be that way, but no. Unfortunately it is.
There's a lot of GPs out there, and I'm sure this is a global thing as well, that just don't have that training in sexual health, or in women's bodies, commas around that. And it's just like, or you'll just get shoved off to a gynecologist who mightn't also have the right kind of training that you might need as well, because you know, you're talking as well, some of the treatments are around psychosexual therapy as well, which is such a completely different world. So it's extremely frustrating. That's why I'm glad that you know, your work exists out there, so that people can maybe hopefully find it on their Google journey into exploring what this is, so that they are forearmed. Talk to me about the treatment then. So you mentioned you were having psychosexual therapy. Is that the only treatment, or what options do people have?
Yeah, there's a whole range of ways to get treated. So for myself, psychosexual therapy and dilating worked wonders. So it was through the therapy process that my therapist suggested I start using the trainers. And I'm always conscious that I feel like I've been really fortunate with my particular progress, because, you know, I had that contact who put me in touch with the therapist who was building up her experience, so it wasn't as expensive as therapists can be. When my therapist suggested dilating, she put me in touch with this amazing sex shop called Shush in London. You might have heard
about them.
Yeah, yeah. And I was able to book an appointment, and I was able to sit down for an hour and a half and just talk to the dilators and familiarize myself with them. So as experiences go, I do feel sometimes guilty and incredibly lucky, because I think, you know, I was in a very good position there. There's psychosexual therapy, there's dilating.
Talk to me about the dilating part, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who might not know what that is.
Yeah, so dilators are essentially a set of, my ones are silicone sticks,
dildos.
Like a penis, but not. Don't look like a penis, by the way.
There's no veins, they're not realistic.
Oh,
looking.
No, okay. No. They're not that realistic. And they go up in size. So I should have got them out actually to show you on camera, but the smallest one is about kind of my particular
size.
Set. Yeah, and they go up in size. And they're basically used to just get your vagina used to having, you know, a penetration. When you are comfortable with the smallest one, you then move to the second, third, fourth, and so on. There's lots of different sets out there. So I use the Shush one. I love them because they're silicone, so they're not plastic. They're not kind of these
safe,
typical plastic ones you see, which, to be honest, if that was my only option back then, I think I wouldn't have touched them with a barge pole.
Plastic isn't really...
They're tapered as well. And also, these ones come with a vibrating bullet because they're all about pleasure as well, so they try and incorporate pleasure into the process.
Oh, fab. That's what I was going to ask, because you're not using them for masturbation as such, or are you just using them to feel something inside and get used to it, or a bit of both?
Really a bit of both. So initially, you know, the purpose is use them to get comfortable with penetration and the whole process. So that's the primary reason. But for me, when I started getting more confident with them, I would incorporate pleasure into the process. And that was amazing. That was like a game changer for me, because obviously if you're enjoying it and you're getting pleasure from it, you want more of it. So it's like this reward cycle. I'd say to anybody, you know, first of all, just it can be quite a daunting process to start. Just try and get used to it. Be really patient with yourself, because sometimes with dilating, it can be like, you know, 2 steps forward, 10 steps back, and it can be frustrating. You've got to persevere, but just be patient with yourself. But as soon as you do get more comfortable and confident, I would personally suggest trying to see if incorporating pleasure helps for you, because it certainly made a difference for me. But yeah, there's more ways to get treated. So psychosexual therapy, there's dilating. Some people have CBT. Some people have, you know, physical therapy where they do pelvic floor exercises. Some people use sex toys as well. So actually, I was talking to Shush recently, and we were saying like the dilators are similar in size to some of their sex toys. So actually, if you really don't like the idea of using dilators because maybe mentally it doesn't appeal or make you feel good,
sure,
there are sex toys you could try as well. Yeah.
It takes like that clinical edge off it, maybe.
Yeah. I've also heard of Botox injections, and I want to mention this because I always go like this when people mention it, but I think, you know, I shouldn't stop talking about, you know, other things just because I've got a bit of a weird reaction to it, because it's
maybe
a viable option for some people. And yeah, I would actually like to know more about it. So if anyone's listening in and has it or has experienced it, I'd love to know more. But
where are they getting the injections?
I think in their vagina or vulva.
Okay.
But it makes me feel... the reason I feel a bit like this is because it's numbing it, which makes me feel slightly nervous. And
yeah.
I wonder if it's kind of a quick fix or a plaster rather than a long-term approach.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's the mind piece as well. There's the psychological element. So that's why I'm nervous. But I would love to know more, because it might have helped other people.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But it feels like a radical thing. It's like Botox.
and just thoughts of needles, I'm not a fan of anyway, but yeah, that's interesting.
Ah. Yeah, and I guess I worry that if somebody has had Botox, have they sorted out the psychological element?
Okay.
And they may not want to. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's up to
different.
Them. Yeah.
Different for everybody. Yeah, okay. And when I was looking up as well, information around it, one of the common things that I kept bumping into was the list of causes of it as well. And a lot of it was around fear of getting pregnant, or fear of the after effects of childbirth, or maybe the actual after effects of childbirth. Is that particularly common? Because you can see how, I mean, I think that's quite a legitimate fear, because pregnancy can be so traumatic, and childbirth can be so traumatic. And it depends on, you know, the culture you're raised in, and the religion, socioeconomic, everything absolutely affects it. So is that a particularly common part? And then, you know, it seems like that would be quite a journey if you got over that fear of being pregnant and then actually got pregnant. That seems like a lot to deal with for your mental health as well.
I haven't spoken to many people who have vaginismus due to a fear of pregnancy, so I can't say loads about it, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I have heard it as one of the reasons. I guess in terms of pregnancy, I've spoken to people who have vaginismus and are worried they won't be able to get pregnant. So I guess opposite to
the opposite,
which is, you know, always a very difficult thing to deal with. But I guess in that regard, I would say there are ways as well. So, you know, you still have a choice. So it might not be a traditional, romantic, lovely way to get pregnant, but artificial insemination is a way to get pregnant. There's, I don't know if you know the sex doctor. She's called Karen Gurney. She's on Instagram as a sex doctor. She put a post out last year about vaginismus and pregnancy, and how, you know, you can buy an artificial insemination kit online. It is an option, it is a choice. You know, while you're kind of getting treated with vaginismus, you don't have to put your life on hold, etc. And this lady happened to see her post, and it was a little while afterwards she contacted Karen, and she said, I have been pushed pillar to post, gone to different GPs and health professionals, you know, about vaginismus and pregnancy, and not one of them has mentioned artificial insemination as a viable option.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I am now pregnant. And it was incredible. Wow. I'll share that post with you afterwards. But I just thought, wow, like that's, and it, had she not posted that on Instagram, this person probably would not be pregnant. And I thought that's life changing.
Yeah. This is why I love social media and people like yourselves for putting that content out there and you know, making information more accessible beyond the realm of the medical setting, or, you know, like you said, for those who can't afford psychosexual therapy, at least they might be able to find a start on Instagram. And, you know, we talk a lot about the bad effects of social media, but the fact that, like you said, that that's life changing, and, you know, there's so much information that's there. And if you collate it all in one place, like with your network, that's just, it is so empowering and life changing. So, I'm so glad that it's there. One of the other things I thought was one of the fears around as a possible causes. So it's fear that the vagina is too small for sexual intercourse. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think that that might stem from a lack of education about our bodies, and if we can't see our vaginas, so our vagina is obviously the internal part, not the whole part, that's the vulva, which is one of my other bugbears. So if you can't see that, you don't know how big it is inside yourself. So we might not know that the vagina actually stretches and all that kind of thing. And then I think the other thing is, where else do we get information about sex from? It's porn, and a lot of the guys in porn are extremely well endowed, because that's porn, it's all about spectacle and theater, and it's not necessarily reflective of the majority of penises out there. Of, I think the average size penis in the UK and Ireland is about 5 inches erect, give or take, whereas in porn that's generally quite a lot bigger as well.
Probably about 12 or 13 inches.
I'm pretty sure there's some records that have been set.
Like a horse.
And that aspect. So if you had that fear that your vagina was too small, and then the only information you saw about erect penises was in porn, that would kind of confirm that fear.
Absolutely.
Because you're kind of going, how is that going to fit inside me?
Yeah, and it's like two extremes, isn't it? If you've got this fear that your vagina, like you say, is too small, and you can't, you don't even look at it anyway, so you don't know, you're not familiar with that part of yourself, and then all the images you see out there are extreme versions of what us as humans are like, then absolutely, that's going to create this mental blocker and fear as well. You're absolutely right.
That's like yet another reason why we need like porn literacy and decent sex education as well, because it just,
I know.
Oh, jeepers, yeah. You talked a lot about like the shame and guilt, and I reached out to a couple of my listeners who had seen that I put up a post saying, oh, this month I'm talking to yourself, and they said that this is amazing and I suffered with this for years. And the key thing that they were saying was that sense of shame and guilt and silence. And that seemed to be reflective, and everything I've looked at on Google about vaginismus is shame and guilt seems to be a huge part of that. So how do you tackle that aspect of this condition?
I think communication is key. Absolutely. Because I guess if I look at almost my previous self, I didn't communicate about this at all.
And 8 years is a long time to not communicate.
Yeah. And even past that, it was a good few years before I spoke to friends about it. And it only took that event that wasn't very nice to kind of make me sit up and deal with it. And I wonder, had that not happened, how much longer would I have continued? Having gone a very long time not talking to anybody about it and internalizing it, to suddenly talk about it and putting myself out there and talking to the likes of yourself and, you know, wonderful people I meet through the network who are living this experience as well, the shift is just massive. And communicating about it, I think, is the only way to alleviate that shame and stigma and the guilt that you should not be feeling, but you unfortunately do, and just to take back some control as well. So I see it at, so Kat and I have held some events, sadly because of COVID. We've done a couple of online ones, but sadly because of COVID, we haven't done one for a while now, but we've held events in London and Glasgow where she lives. And after the event, you just look around the room and there's a room full of, you know, people with this shared condition, but who are interesting, funny, articulate, wonderful people, and it's so empowering to see them all there. And you think, you know, yes, this is the one thing that we share, but you're so much more than that. And to see them talking about it is amazing. And you can almost see the shame just falling a little bit. So I would just say communication is key, but oh my bloody God, it's hard. Like, yeah, you know, I know how hard it is to talk about it. But I always think, if you open up to somebody about it and they're not cool with it, or they will judge you, then do you really want to be friends with them anyway? Or, you know, that's their problem, that's not your problem. Maybe, you know, as a tip to somebody who hasn't talked about it before, I think, I know for me, when I first started talking to friends about it, it felt so monumental because I'd build it all up in my head. And I thought, how can I articulate this story that's all twisted in my mind? I think actually, if you are going to speak to somebody and you don't know how to explain it, just send them a link to the Vaginismus Network or another useful resource, which explains what it is. And then that sort of does that part for you. And then you can have a conversation with them around, and this is what it means for me, and this is what I'm trying to do about it. So that might help potentially. But yeah. Communication all the way.
90% of sexual issues, communication yes. plays such an important part. I like your point there is really interesting about if friends are shaming you, but I also think that's important for partners as well. Like if they're putting pressure on you, that you have to have penis and vagina sex if you're hetero, or you have to use sex toys, or you have to use fingers, whatever it happens to be. I think it's really important to name that as not healthy behavior and veering into abusive behavior as well. If someone's putting pressure on you to have sex yeah. in a way that's causing you harm and trauma, like that's not a healthy relationship.
Yeah, and based on what you've just said, my fear is that there's many people with vaginismus who will allow themselves to have those experiences that can be abusive, because they feel like they're not good enough, or they kind of owe it to the other person. So it's incredibly worrying. I have heard from a partner of somebody, gosh, this was a long time ago, and the things that this person, I'm trying to be not specific because I don't want to name and shame anybody, sure. so I won't say when or whatever, but the things that this partner was saying were very worrying for me, because it was basically woe me, and I'm putting up with this person, and I'm not getting the sex life I should be getting as a young man, and I was fuming.
Of course.
Dealt with that in my own way, and I get that it impacts a partner. Absolutely, I get that. But I think that's a very damaging mindset to have, and it's not helpful for the person's progress. On the flip side, you know, you get wonderful partners. So when I did a Q&A with Shush online a couple of months ago, and a male partner wrote in about his female partner, and he said, you know, I want her to feel more confident, and I really want to support her. What more can I do? I never want to put pressure on her. And I just thought that was wonderful. Like, he was asking for tips, and he That's was putting lovely. Himself out there as well. But yeah, interestingly, we're talking about partners and communication. I, about 2 or 3 years ago, reached out to my very first boyfriend, because when I started to kind of put a face to the name, and, you know, I thought, actually, I should probably just reach out to him and explain it, just in case he happens to see something or hear something or whatever, because whilst I don't name names and give specifics, I do talk about that relationship. And I shared with him what I was doing, and I said, look, vaginismus was always the issue and that we didn't talk about. And he said to me, he lived the 8-year relationship thinking he was the one with the issue. And I thought, isn't that incredible? Like, because we couldn't communicate for some reason, because we both, he lived the relationship thinking he was the one who was broken or not doing something. I lived it thinking I was the one. It seems so sad and incredible.
Yeah.
And I,
And fair play to you for doing that. That's such a hard thing to do for a lot of people, you know, like to reach out. And if that was a healthy relationship, it's obviously a lot easier. But if someone has been negative about it, you know, you might want to talk to them, and why should you? There's so much that you're saying, like the common theme is like lots of missed opportunities for I suppose ownership of your body in a really authentic way, and ownership of your pleasure. And like that's essentially coming down to lack of sex education, how we talk about the vagina in media and culture in society, and that impacts like religion and culture as well, and how we talk about sex as well, like we said, like that sex is just penis and vagina sex, and that's it, and you know, and that's generally like once a man comes, and that's sex is over, and we had that trope, and
let's go to sleep,
like that's mainstream media, that's porn, that's so much of our conversation. So I admire the path that you're kind of carving through all that nonsense and just trying to create that as well. Is a part of your future plans, I'm not sure if you do at the moment, but to go into schools as part of sex education and explain that this, you know, is probably a lot more common than we realize, because people stay so silent about it, it's probably a lot more widespread than we think. So is that in the plan, or is that something that you engage with at the moment?
I would definitely love to do more in that space. I do have a full-time job on the side of this, so I guess it's if ever I find the time, but also I guess the wider resources, because I think there's so much more to be done in sex education. So yes, talking about conditions like vaginismus, but also so many more things. And there's some wonderful people out there who are great sex educators, who I'm sure are going to be doing this as well. So if we could get involved in some way, that would be great. I did speak at a university last year. So I went to Oxford. I was part of a panel event. It was like a Q&A with some students, and a student actually contacted me recently about doing a live Facebook event with one of their committees. So there's definitely kind of interest. What I think is great through both these experiences is it was students who reached out to us because they're interested in these kind of topics, and they're interested in learning more and empowering others. And I think, you know, that I'm talking like I'm 60 here, I'm only mid 30s, but that kind of next generation of, you know, late teens, early 20s, it feels like there's a bit of a wave, and you know, a keenness to understand and be better educated, and an openness to, you know, all the kind of messages we're putting out there. I remember when I spoke at Oxford last year, this young guy, it's always stuck with me, we did the Q&A, and he said to me, oh, I've got a question for you. He said, I've got a female friend who recently told me she has vaginismus, and I didn't quite know what to say. And then he said, what can I do to be a better friend to her? And I thought, you are
lovely.
Bloody lovely. But yeah, we've had students reach out for like magazines and stuff. So there definitely seems to be an interest. And like I say, it's great that it's coming from them rather than us saying, right, listen to what we've got to say.
Yeah,
really cool.
That's lovely. Yeah, and it is part of like, you know, that younger generation having a lot more openness around sex and maybe less societal norms as such, you know, that they have to strictly adhere to. I mean, sex in Ireland a few years ago, like, basically didn't exist outside marriage and outside having 5 million children in your family. So, you know, we've come a long way since then. And but like, you know, like any kind of condition around sex just wouldn't have really been looked at, and your doctors wouldn't have been trained, and you probably would have been told to go to a priest to discuss it with your priest, and we all know that that's not exactly the right way to go about it. So definitely
I remember my sex education was I've said this before, it was so It was so basic and it almost felt like an afterthought, because I think we were supposed to have it in year 7 or 8, so start of secondary school. And then I think I was in year 9 or 10, and I remember the science teacher kind of saying, oh, we were supposed to do this a while ago and we didn't, or whatever, and like, right, we're going to watch this video today. And it just seemed a bit rushed and embarrassed. And I can still see it. It was a cartoon and it said, when a man and a woman love each other, man and woman,
the only way you can have sex.
They fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. And that was the message, and it stuck in my head. And there was stuff about periods, but I think the boys were sent out the room. I can't remember specifically, but it was so basic. But you know what, I always think, and it might be happening now, I'm not you know, that close to it, but I think it would be so much better if the sex education was delivered by somebody objective and external, because my poor science teacher having to do it, like, he looked a bit embarrassed as well. And
yeah, no, of course.
It's
yeah.
not cool. Like, it should be
someone different. Yeah. That's currently the case in Ireland. Like, 50% of sex ed is outsourced, which is objectively good, but they're not necessarily outsourced to actual qualified trained professionals. It's a lot of religious organizations that take it up. So yeah, we have a long way to go, but we do have a sex education review, hopefully decent sex ed coming in next year, so we'll hope that Vaginismus is on it as well. We'll see how that goes. So brilliant, Lisa, you've been amazing to chat to, and I've learned so much from you today, and I'm really glad that your network exists out there in the world, and so that people can find you rather than googling the clinical scary videos and, you know, you're a nice face to put on it, you know, yourself and Kat. So it is really important to do that work, and I have huge admiration for people who have that mindset of, I want to be the person that I didn't have growing up. You know, I think that's just so huge, because that's where authentic change comes from. So I think that's yeah. So pat on the back for you there.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. So nice to talk to you.
No, of course not. Where can people find you if they want to drop you a line or get involved or share their story?
So we've got a website, so vaginismusnetwork.com. You can contact us via that. You can email us vaginismusnetwork@gmail.com if you want to share your story, write for us, just have a good old vent about vaginismus. If you want to get buddied up with someone, just send us your age, if you're comfortable to provide it, location, and how you'd like to be connected with someone, and we can sort that out for you. We're on Twitter. Need to do more on Twitter. I'm a bit of an Instagram person, to be honest. So our main activity and platform really is Instagram. So we're at the Vag Network on Instagram.
Excellent, excellent. And yeah, like I said, it's a lovely, colourful, accessible page on Instagram. So it's, you know, there's no scary graphic close-ups or people in white coats.
I'm a sucker for colours, so.
Yeah, no, it absolutely, it's a powerful tool. So yeah, you're doing it well. So brilliant. Lisa, thank you so much. And please extend my thanks to Cad as well, because you're both doing amazing work. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Lovely speaking to you.
And bye. Thank you to all my listeners as well. If you really like our conversation, please rate and review over on Apple. And we're on Twitter and Instagram at the Glow West Podcast, all one word. And if you really, really like us and you want to help contribute to the running of the podcast, we're on Patreon, and that's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I appreciate your time, and we will see you next week.